But I mean, Prop 16 was really the start, right?
It's the reason we continued. It's the reason we continued.
Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams.
Hello and welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams. And I did not just read that from a transcript from episode 130, and I totally had that memorized and by heart. So today it's just, this is Usurper, and Schulze and I are here, and we're joined by Tim from Story Protocol. Tim, welcome.
Thank you very much. Yeah, glad to be here. Also my second time on podcast. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Nice. Schulze, it's about our second.
It feels like every time it feels like a new time. I'm like, hey, it's podcast time again. Oh,
like, what am I doing? I know.
Yeah.
It's our second professional podcast with you here. So that's good. Yeah. So welcome. So I know you guys had a little conversation beforehand, and maybe we could kick off a little bit, and Tim, maybe you want to give a little background on yourself and things like that. And we can, I don't know, Schulze, if you had an agenda, I don't want to step on it. So.
Oh, I have no agenda, I assure you.
Oh, free flow then. I think I just kick in on and give a short and intro. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my name is Tim Pin Tim. So that's my ID, and all social media is Tim Tim Tim. So small story behind this name was because Tim.east was too expensive. And then Tim Tim.east was not special enough. So I saw it's not two, it's not four. Let's go for three. So that's how I got my first ENS, and then lately it become the iconic thing on me, the Tim Tim Tim. Yeah. So I currently serve as a validator lead at Story, also supervising on the infrastructure partnership and also DevRel side. Yeah. So that's how I met everyone here who runs validator nodes with us. And got invited as well. So a bit of my background. I started off in this industry around two, three years ago when I first studied doing my master's. I was doing some research on blockchain and intellectual property, how we can use blockchain to revamp the copyright protection system in traditional like governance perspective. And then I got into Binance, the exchange, and then transitioned myself to DevRel at the BNB chain. So after that, I joined Flock. It's an AI and crypto company. So mm-hmm. I was the head of DevRel there, and then now I'm at Story.
How long have you been at Story?
I'm starting my fifth month. So I've served a complete 4 months, which felt like a year passed.
When did the business launch? Do you know?
So Story business.
Yeah.
Yeah. Quite around 3 years ago.
Oh, is it that long?
Similar, closer to 3 years rather than two. Yeah.
And was there any launches on Story before? Kind of what's going on now, or was like did it go through a couple iterations, or what's the history there? Do you know?
I actually did a lot of research back in September when they announced second round. I was still like a witness. So and overviewing the whole company and got very attracted. So I took a look. So actually 3 years ago, initially started off as a IP franchiser, and mm-hmm. then bridged into blockchain. So last September, the second round announced, and then they had this first blog came out to describe the Git repository for IP, which is the proof of creativity protocol. And then after Denver, we moved on to L2 and then now L1. So everything, so from protocol to L2 to L1 actually just happened this year.
I gotcha. That makes sense. Huh. So and it was an L2 on Ethereum, like it was straight L2?
Yes, yes. Yeah. So it's more like through the roll up as a service, you know, like Calendon.
Sure. And so now it's an L1 using Tendermint, right?
Yeah.
I don't know too much. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's similar to Barrachain in that there is a it's using Tendermint as consensus, and then it uses Geth as the execution layer.
Yep, that's correct.
That's all the rage these days.
It is. Yeah. It works though. It's pretty stable.
It's stable as shit. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it just depends. What kind of block? Well, I want to talk about block times. We get to that point later, maybe.
So Tim, how why the validator role? Like, why are you leading validators? If you were doing IP stuff and got a master's in that, like, messing around in the dirt with us seems a little off kilter.
I don't feel like it's off kilter. So I sometimes describe myself as the death rail for validators. As we know, like, so I didn't, to be very honest, before joining this role, I had zero experience running a validator. I've run a Bitcoin validator, a Bitcoin node, during the time where the other nodes first came out, like the end of January, February last year. And then I was like, this thing is too hard. Like, it's complex in a way, yeah, where it doesn't allow you to do stuff easily. So I fully synced the node and I gave up. So I still have the node on my PC, but it's just I didn't run it for a long time.
Right.
But after like the past 4 months has been, obviously we know that we launched two testnet. We are launching our new testnet Zoom, and then we launched our first testnet. So talking to a lot of validators, more than around 100 validators, I feel like I'm kind of getting to know what's going on with the whole community. It's really no difference compared to how I do DevRel before. Setting up community, providing technical support, and then also, you know, railing DevRel into building stuff. I think now, like, doing that, doing validator is not enough, right? Keep your uptime for 99.99%. It seems to be a golden standard. Like, everyone just follows. So beyond that, we are looking at more stuff like how you support the ecosystem, what tools you are building to support the community, rather than just saying, oh, I just run a node and then I just provide support. So I do see like you need to have someone who has a kind of a developer mindset and also able to handle the community to be on this road to support all the validators.
Yeah, that makes sense. How many validators do you intend to have come mainnet or the next testnet?
So let's go from the testnet first. So for the existing new Odyssey testnet, we are looking at a total of 112 active set. So we have 8 Genesis validator. So which means we will be releasing around 104 slots to the validator selection. We will be doing a delegation based rotation system where we're gonna delegate the tokens to the validators.
Interesting.
And then for the mainnet, we are looking at in total again, like, we have the 8 Genesis validator, and also around the total will be 64. So which means the community and partners will share 56 spare slots for the rest of the validator.
Wait, can you say that again?
So we have in total 64 for mainnet, and then we have 8 Genesis.
Yep, I got it. Okay, so the 8 are, so those would be foundation validators, or those just be chosen mainnet validators that want to launch with?
You mean the 8 Genesis or the 56? Yeah. Eight Genesis are actually partners. So we have a partnership before we launch the blockchain.
Got it. So like Coinbase, Kraken, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Got it. Interesting. So why 112 slots if you're gonna have 64 total to get better metrics of all the testnet ones?
I think initially speaking, when I look at our current status of Iliad, so we have around 9,500 nodes running at the moment.
Oh, geez.
And also, yes, we are not as bad as Inisha. Inisha had 13K, you know, they had 13K nodes. Doing an evaluation on the existing role. So we do have a rogue gated entrance to get involved in validator chat. I have around 1,000 people. So I think, cool. I do believe when we actually have 100 set of 104 active set may not be good enough. So the reason for 112 is actually doubles the 56, right? So we want to assess as many people at one patch as possible so we can actually just rotate out. Also provide a good chance for us to stress test our network, just in case if we have a network expansion plan in the future, how we're going to handle like such a big, you know, large number of validators.
So how soon is mainnet then? Because if you're already thinking like, let's choose your core set, it's got to be relatively soon, right?
I don't know, man. We're still deciding. I think there's a lot of bug fixing, and also since the other core comment is there is that the O2C is actually a brand new network. It's not like you just swap your nodes out and then you have the version upgrade. So it is a brand new network that that should provide some similar experience to what we are looking at the future, but also, you know, things may happen differently. Like sometimes you have the plan and then things happen beyond the plan, then we need to draft out a further step. So I can't do any promise here, but hopefully, you know, we are launching Zune, and also this is gonna be last one. But that just a hope.
Sure.
Yeah.
So do you wanna talk about Story Protocol at all?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a lot of question around why L1, and then also why IP, and then also like why just blockchain. I think we can literally touch base on that perspective. So let's begin from like what exactly Story does. So we are now Story. We don't call ourselves Story Protocol anymore. So because Story Protocol is actually the protocol on top of our chain. So the chain is called Story. So I'll be using Story onwards. So the first thing is we didn't intentionally to build an L1. So it wasn't in the plan. It slightly got dragged by the technical difficulties and also like the performance of layer 2 didn't reach to the to our kind of expectation. So we obviously we since last September when we raised the second round, we actually proposed the idea of building a protocol. So what this protocol does is it's the from my personal perspective, I think it's the visualization of how we transfer IP on chain. So the issue we are solving here is that traditionally talking about intellectual property, talking about copyright, you often get into a very ambiguous position where how we visualize the relationship between IP ownership, between the rights ownership above, beyond IP, for example, like adoption rights, publication rights, and then performance rights. It's very ambiguous, and then it's very hard to kind of how we say it's feeling it physically, because they are all contracts. One thing great about NFT and blockchain is that we actually can encapsulate those rights into an entity, and then through that entity we are able to visualize all the relationship, because it's a transaction and then it's an object. And then beyond that is that by adding the 6551 ERC 6551, the token bounded account idea, we are able to create an extra wrapper around the NFT object to make it more executionable. So where we created the execution layer, allowing those IP assets to become a wallet, where through that we enable the artist, the creator, to have the module access, such as licensing module, to help them fix resolving all the license issue after their IP become famous, and also the royalty module. So if one want to use the original IP to create derivatives, you can always track back the royalty usage, and also the dispute module to prevent infringement or violation. So that's the base protocol level approach we did.
Maybe okay. This is a silly question. Sorry for interrupting, but would this be like legally binding, right? Could you potentially take it to court? Are there any lawyers involved that can like review contracts? Are there?
So currently our license template. So we do have a special term called license template where we attach to each IP asset. So through that license template, we can define whether the usage of the derivative or the usage of the IP is commercial or non-commercial or no use. So these IP templates were remapped from existing American copy intellectual property law. So internally, we do have a legal team that is working closely with different lawyers to push the narrative of using this license template. I think So obviously at the moment, so we see few cases where we allow NFT as a evidence. So when you actually have the stolen assets or someone drain your wallet, you can actually bring it to court and court will resolve it as a part of assets lost. So but I think at by now we still haven't seen any cases using story protocol as the main sure. evidence. I think we just need to walk that first step. So we need to have that first case came out and then see how the law existing law system responds to it. Because without any actual practical action, we cannot just assume it work or assume it doesn't work.
It's kind of curious because I remember whenever I first got into like my professional life and I used DocuSign for the first time, I was like, surely this couldn't actually be legally binding, right? Because you're not actually signing anything. But really, that's not really what matters. What matters is kind of the intent. And you were the person that clicked like, yes, sign. So it works, right? And in theory, using a wallet for that would be just as effective, if not more binding. And so in theory, it makes sense to like create some sort of DocuSign out of Story, right? And then have yeah. like, here's your wallet to sign here. And then now your contract, maybe there's some way of like not putting your contract on chain, right? Because you don't want like NDAs on there, whatever. But creating some sort of binding that could then be legally binding in that form.
Yeah. Also, just leveraging on what you just said. I think in a way, wallet is a very strong entity representation because you are the only one knows your seed phrase. And then also we have something called sign protocol. They actually allows you to sign directly on chain and then use your wallet as an entity to validate different contracts. So I think wallet as an entity definitely makes sense in a lot of scenario where because you are the only one knows your seed phrase. And then we always tell people that you don't exploit your seed phrase, you don't exploit your private key. So then in other words is that no other people in this world should know your seed phrase or your private key.
Sure. Tim, what do you deal with how do you guys approach things around either identity and or validity of IP? Because some of these IP tool sets that are out there have research teams to validate that something that somebody's putting up as IP is their own, trying to catch fraud early on. Like using the blockchain as a ledger for, hey, I own something and we want to license something. That transaction seems extremely straightforward to me. The part I see as being the issue was like, number one, you have to be recognized as being an organization. Like you have to be recognized as being a system that is trustworthy, right? That this is an actual entity that has enough IP and has some validity around it, right? Because this literally came up out of nowhere in the last 3 years. So, right. So there has to be that piece of it. And then number two, if it's full of bullshit, like if it's full of just people spamming things around whatever the hell they want to do with it, then you have like the signal to noise ratio to say, no, that stuff over there, yeah, all that doesn't make any sense. But this thing that I IP'd is true. So like that, which is totally away from the technology, right? Like anybody can generate a wallet. I can impersonate 1,000 different people. I can take ownership of all these different things. How do you guys going to solve that problem? Because that seems like something that technology doesn't solve.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned is great. I think it's a great angle, to be honest. Like a lot of people would directly just ask me like how you protect how you prevent infringing, how you protect violation. But to be very honest, like human action is unpreventable. Like people yeah. can do like all the actions beyond your imagination and then just to infringe it or violating it. So we have two angles looking into this type of this question. So one is how we use blockchain as a tool to accelerate the evidence collection process. Okay. So basically my master research was on this, how to prove that blockchain is a more effective tool to prevent, to accelerate the evidence collection because you have the timestamp, right? Yep. So the timestamp can actually be, the first thing that people look at the timestamp is more like, oh, you are proving the fact that this guy is a original creator of this IP. But we can also reversely looking at the timestamp. So we can also use that timestamp to prove that this person actually infringing existing IP because it's a unique timestamp happening at that moment. So if we took that timestamp further, we are able to accelerate the speed of partially collecting the evidence because we can just use the timestamp to use that block information to prove the ownership of the that NFT object. And then the other work will be more of the off-chain side, how we identify the ownership of the like the people who raised the case.
Mm-hmm.
So actually 2019, there's a case happened in China. So China has a very rich intellectual property chain kind of ecosystem. So there are 8 different IP chain in China. So Baidu actually sued TikTok. I think it's Baidu sued TikTok on video infringing. So they actually, it was the first time in history people used blockchain to collect the evidence. And then it's just dramatically speed up the whole evidence collection process. So normally speaking, at the moment, like during the IP infringement or violation, we are talking about years, because you have the lawyers to collect both materials and evidence to actually proving the fact that you are the original owner. And then, you know, when you are trying to sue like larger corporations or larger tech companies, it may take longer time due to the fact that how like larger corporation may have a longer process in order to get the evidence. So if we are able to use blockchain as a transparent and traceable tool, it actually hugely speed up the whole evidence collection speed. So that's one. Mm-hmm. And then the second part I want to answer, how I answer this question, is that we are actually working with a lot of traditional IP. So we want to say, I think onboarding traditional large IP corporations such as Disney, such as Fox, such as Japanese anime company like Toei, or Kyoto Animation, or A1 Pictures, or Korean company such as Netmarble, is very vital to us as well. Because only if we can get a validation from them, we are able to use it as a successful case to tell rest of the people or rest of the world that this makes sense, right? You want to have sure. A large name to come first before you kind of have all the attraction for rest of the world to use it. So we are working heavily into building the relationship, building those connections with traditional creator companies.
And do those companies actually, I don't know the IP space very well, but do those companies actually publish that data publicly? Like, can I search those specific examples that you mentioned? Can I go to their site and search for a specific piece of IP and see the same thing? I can see a timestamp when it was created. I can see creator. I can see documents associated to that. Does that even exist?
I think different. As far as I know, like different countries has a IP database. So because it's intellectual property law is actually very complex. So yeah. It's actually region specific. So different country will have their own type of law. You can go through the intellectual property database to go through what type of IP or what type of patent or even like a business secret they registered within that intellectual property department.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, actually, being country specific, because then I said before around you have to have recognition, right? Like you have to be viewed as an organization or as a data source that can be trusted and felt that there's accurate information coming out of that. But really, you have to do that in every country, because each country, if it does go to court, just because somebody, like you said before, like that example of TikTok or something, just because China said so, US would say, doesn't matter, right? Like US courts would not look at that, right? So that means you basically have to relitigate that in every single organization or every country where that might come up, right?
Yes. I guess. So actually, just to add on, like cross region lawsuiting is very hard. It's extremely hard.
It would
hard.
Be impossible, it, right? Yeah.
It's possible, but it will take a very long time for both parties to collaborate, to cooperate together.
Right.
So one of my relatives actually fall into this pitfall this black hole of cross region intellectual property suiting cases. So yeah. I know exactly how painful it is. Like you want both parties to consent to the evidence. So that take a lot of time.
Unless the IP holder actually has properties in those regions. Nobody's using Mickey Mouse and fucking any, like they're not using it anywhere because Disney has a foothold in every single country, right? So they're going to protect that IP no matter what. But not everybody can do that, obviously, right? So if I'm an IP holder, on Story in the US on Story, right? Or I have things that are in there in terms of that. Does that help me protect copyrights in Saudi Arabia or in China or anywhere else? Does that make it at least easier?
I think at the moment we haven't really touched base on that side. I think it's on the roadmap. I believe we still need to work step by step rather than directly jumping into region specific copyright. So first off, that's why we actually used U.S. copyright law or U.S. Intellectual property law as the first step to remap on chain, allowing us to understand how this intellectual property law works.
That's cool. Is the U.S. one of the most lax or the most strict when it comes to that stuff?
I think I believe it's most strict. It's considered Disney has one of the Disney. So two company has the most strongest legal team in terms of intellectual property. One is Disney. The other one is Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
they are literally the two company has you know the strongest legal team. So if we American probably is the side of Disney, and then Japan is the side of Nintendo. Right. But still, Nintendo has a U.S. base. So I believe America is still considered as the most mature intellectual property law.
Right.
So for something, let's say I have a book that I wrote. Or a world that I wrote, like Jar Jar R. Martin, would there be a way for me to submit my provenance on chain so that other people could verify it? Like, say I want to create an NFT of my, of like 100 books that are first edition that come with like a physical book. Is there any way people could check on chain that I am indeed said author and prove provenance without having to go on my website or do like Web2 things?
I think it will be strongly bounded to your wallet, like how you set up your identity linking to your wallet. I still think identity side is very off chain. You can't unless we are moving from a from an off chain world to a on chain kind of a passport situation. Where I heard Singapore will start rolling out on chain identity in the future. So if we actually have an on-chain identity that proving you are like a KYC or know your customer, then I believe it works. But other than that, in real scenario, we still need to use your off-chain identity to prove that you are the owner of the wallet, and then you are then proving that you are the owner of the piece of work. So there's no easy way to actually validate that. Otherwise, it will be ZK passport.
Yeah. So will Story be dealing with identities directly, or use something like Checked protocol in order to handle identities?
I believe we don't do it directly at the moment. It's still yet to be discussed, but I think working with third party always help us to reinventing the wheels. And also we do have a dispute model. Like a lot of staking protocol is working with us. One is creating this economic trust, so further leverage on top of trust factor. And then you also have the dispute model to module to dispute on IP. So if people think that you infringed other work, they can always provide evidence and more evidence provided by the community member than probably actually means you're infringing existing IP off chain.
Wait, they're staking. So I submit a book.
Yeah.
My wallet. And then someone can stake to my IP and say, this is valid.
Yes.
And then other people can anti-stake. They can dispute it. So, yeah. Okay. So I guess two follow-up questions there. One, for staking, do you get rewards? And if you get rewards, where do the rewards come from? Is there is part of the staking rewards in general just siphoned off for those staking to IP? And two, what happens during a dispute? Like how does that, who moderates that?
So first question, similar to Lido or Lido or other staking module, you actually, because it's a delegation proof of stake mechanism consensus, so you actually can gain APY that actually staking reward directly from the staking protocol and then from the validators and then
Wait, hold on. So from the blockchain. Okay, so you can't stake with the IP, you stake with the validator, and the validator kind of backs an IP?
Actually, you stake on top of IP, so you stake directly into the IP. So for example, our staking protocol will work with validators. So
got it. Okay, so it kind of treats it like a
you're staking like an NFT.
Yeah.
Like we talked about that elsewhere too, right? Like the other teams are trying to do that too, or you find, which I guess there it was more around the possible, it wasn't necessarily in an IP related fashion, right? It was something that might have an increase in value over time. I'm not talking about elsewhere. Like they were talking about like, hey, I have this NFT, and this NFT is aligned to maybe a real world asset, or it's aligned to something else, has a specific value to it, and a stake to that. And as that value grows, the overall mint that occurs, that portion of that reward that gets distributed out to staked items, and then this one is the value of X versus the total Y, and so therefore it increases in value and I make money, type of idea, right? So that,
yeah.
And you said you can anti-stake though? What is
It's not anti-stake. It's about raising a dispute.
So
you can't anti-stake.
Okay, all right. That would be crazy.
I
want to reduce this amount.
To be honest, the whole idea behind staking on IP is to create this trust factor, right? So if you actually trust that this is an original piece, obviously you want to stake in, and then so when the IP become more famous, you gain more rewards from your stake. But also at the same time, people can dispute on top of the IP, because if they found out evidence, and then they can dispute. They provide the evidence, and community, I think currently speaking, community will vote, because we cannot be a centralized authority to judge the whole dispute process. It's more like a community engagement process. We are working on a refactor of current dispute module. So we haven't yet came out to be the final idea.
So would that go through like the governance module for doing a dispute? Because putting the power of disputes within validators' hands, it's not there. Don't do it.
So from my imagination, it will be more like it's still a very hard question, right? How much community members should be engaged in this? You can't really engage the stakers. You need to engage slightly more community member in order to make it as more than 50% voting, and then if you engage primarily stakers on staking on that IP, probably they don't want to get dispute, because when they get dispute, you'll get slashed. So I do think it's a harder question now, just to think more kind of a matured module in order to figure out like who's able or who has the rights to get involved in such a dispute decision.
Yeah, you're basically taking regular individuals and turning them into IP patent lawyers.
Yeah.
Right,
which like is not professional.
It's dangerous, actually, in some of those areas, because you might not be. I mean, nobody understands IP law. Number two, people could also say that it shouldn't exist in the U.S. Like it should go away. Like the idea of and the amount of patent trolls and shit like that. I think this goes towards solving that. Let me make sure I say that. But there's not a lot of love for IP, right? And if you get like the wrong type of group of pitchforks in there, you might have somebody slashed on something that's totally valid, right? At least might not be liked, but what is actually legal versus what is correct is legal versus what is right might not be at all the same thing, right? Like there's tons of fucking examples of those two being on the opposite ends of what's going on. So that would be an interesting experiment. And the other thing is, like, I'd be curious on what, like, if that helps or hurts from a court perspective, on the validity of the platform and those types of things too. You know what I mean? Because like, then you have like lawyers arguing that, well, this is not a real thing because it's this community driven and people are making decisions and people are losing their portion of their IP value because of blah blah blah. You know what I mean? And you open up like all these doors. But This is such a messy area.
It's
a really tough problem to solve. Blockchain, no blockchain. Like, this is like a really tough problem.
It's a real problem, to be honest.
It's
like a lot of people doesn't understand IP. Of course, like they don't engage with IP, right? Only if you start to like having your creation and then somebody start violating your rights on your creation, and then you start actually realizing, damn, my IP matters, because how I describe IP kind of issue is it's really about economic. It's more economic than ever. About your earnings, about your money gain, and then about your profit, and then people start realizing, damn, it's an issue. Like, I need to solve this issue in order to gain back my portion of revenue.
The other thing is the other thing that's interesting, which is the timing of this whole thing, which is back in Schulte's book example. Like, if this came up 10 years ago, and Schulte writes a book, and we somehow hash that, we put a SHA up somewhere, and it says, hey, this is Schulte's book. We can verify the text, and here's a hash of that. And so we can put that as an NFT, and we can verify that at this point, Schulte wrote this book that has this content, right? We know that. But today, when you talk about like LLMs and like image generators and those types of things, like, I could do fucking dog with hat, right? And shove that into an image generator, generate 10 million variations of that, put them all into story. And then at some point a year from now, somebody was dog with hat on it, and I go after him and said, look, I created this. Yes, I also created 22 other million of those, but this one is totally the same. It has the same, it's the same dog, it has the same fucking hat, it has the same logo, because it's just like 1,000 monkeys and 1,000 typewriters, right? So like, that's a whole, like, that. So there's a lot of conversation. We've had extra conversations here about, like, what does IP even mean? Because is it the output of that? Is it the input to get to that piece? And like, as you start this LM thing, and now you have this massive engine generator that's generating all this stuff, like, what is actual IP anymore? Like, where does that fit in? And so it's a tough time it's a weird time to actually like get into this too, because you have like this issue, right?
I think it's because of that. It's even a better timing, because we're trying to validate like doing the process of using, for example, LLM. So which part you actually start creating, right? Obviously, you talk about the data ownership of your, so I think IP is beyond like about creation. It's also like your data. So we always talk that data ownership, and then beyond that, and also like model ownership. So I came from an AI Web3 company. So there's actually within AI field, there's a strong debate on the data ownership. Like, we scrape all the open web data to create such a big model, and also to make these model more clever and then more like human. Yeah. But where does data ownership came from? Like do we ever authorize them to use our creation? Because human are generating data every second. Like, we are here streaming, so every second we stream here, every words we talk here is a proportion of data contributing to the open web that will be shared around to many people. So do we actually own these data we created? Because if we are not here to talk about or use this stream, probably this proportion of data will not exist, right?
Yeah, nobody's watching it anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but still, like, we're here trying to create this episode.
Yeah.
So I think that part, proportion of I think it's the authorization part of the ownership matters. Like, authorizing that you are the owner of your data. And then the second part is when you talk about like people creating like 10,000 of 10,000 different dog with a hat image, I think that take time, right? That take a lot of time. Like, you gotta make it variant on that. Obviously, that from my point of view, I see there's several ownership there, like the data used to train the model, and then creator of the model, and then also the user who use prompt to generate those image. So there are three type of ownership we're looking at here, and then the output will definitely be like part of the the main proportion of the ownership will flow into the user who prompt in, and yep. then just a second part of proportion will be the data, and then last one will be the model.
Right.
That's how I see this. So then, so Gen AI era, we value the originality more, even more, because mm-hmm. it's rare. It just become rare compared to like 10 years ago when everyone used pen and paper to write a book. Now everyone trying to use Gen AI. I believe like similarly, we're gonna generate a lot of Gen AI trash on the internet. Already is there are a lot already. Then compared with how we generate a lot of NFT like you know, zero NFT on chain. It's in a similar situation, to mm-hmm. be very honest.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. I think that, I don't even know. I couldn't even predict like in the next 10 years, like related to all those issues you just mentioned. Like number one, proving ownership of source data that went into an AI engine. Number two, is the model IP? The source data is IP. Is the output IP? And then, If that output it has value, how do you even tie that back to say this is the structure that came up with that, right? And I'm not even talking about like single images. I'm already seeing short movies. I expect we'll see full length movies that come out that through those types of models. Like there's going to be large, like it's going to be massive strides in the next 10 years associated with some of these types of things. And the reality will increase. And then what does that reality really mean? And what are the source images that came from that? Like, it's just going to be I guess there's IP through all that, right? So it'll be interesting.
Well, what's also interesting is that there already is something of a case study for derivative works, right? Like, what was it? Vanilla Ice used Under Pressure in doing.
By who?
Under Pressure by David Bowie.
No, Queen.
I thought they were both in it.
I don't think Bowie was in it, was he? Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, so there's already like derivative works, right? And Vanilla Ice was sued for doing so, right? So we already know there's some sort of level of case study. But the question really becomes like, what would the intellectual property be? Would it be the art itself? Or is the text that creates the generated prompt, is like, would that be intellectual property? Like just the sequences of words that you used. Like that one guy, he won that art contest using AI, that space opera kind of image. I don't know if you've seen it. I love it. I think the image is just fantastic, but he's really upset because other people are using it. And it's like, do you have any leg to stand on? I don't know.
I think what it matters in the end is actually about licensing. Like if we can have a better, you know, transparent licensing model, like attached to the creation, I think it will help a lot. It will genuinely help a lot in the future. Like when we obviously Pirate Bay happens because people doesn't want to pay, but still a strong vast majority of the people who want to use the work, but who cannot be able to like contact the original author or having a long negotiation period, like who want to pay for it just couldn't pay. Then if we can have this on-chain like a decentralized licensing system, it actually help a lot. You don't need to negotiate with the owner anymore. All you need to know is whether you have enough funds to purchase the license token, and then through that license token we validate whether you have the rights to do stuff or not.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't even know if it was payment. I don't think people have an issue with paying for items for the most part. I mean, some do, don't get me wrong. I think it is a friction of that, though. I think what you hit on, right? Like, Tim, I think that's exactly it. Like, if there's a way to reduce the friction and I can figure out how to even do that, and I can use something in that situation, then and do that in a single serving type of effort. Because I think one of the areas that I get always pissed off at is image licensing from like the large image licensors, where if you want to license a single use of an image, it's ridiculously expensive, or it gets pushed into like a yearly subscription type of shit, right? And like for anything, and you just want to, I want to be able to use an image for the website, or I want to use it for something else. And there's no simple way of being able to do that because or it requires too much data transfer, or it requires me to buy a year long subscription or something, or it's just like the prices are ridiculously high because they want to get you in a subscription. Like those are all things that I think that that story could do well with. I think blockchain does really well with too, right? Because there's it's difficult to sell. I mean, I guess you could sell a subscription in that chain, but it would be, I think it'd be difficult to do that, right? Based on like trying to bundle and all this kind of stuff across this really complicated data set, since you're not gonna have more than just one type of IP item, you know? So yeah, totally agree. Look, somebody joined up.
Oh, hey guys.
What's happening?
Not much, just babysitting.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Were you listening in?
I was to begin with, and then like I just had yelling in my ear. It was kind of hard.
Oh,
and now the yelling's gone. We have like a small amount of silence. I thought I'd come say hey.
Yeah. Tim Null has a 6 week? 6 week.
Is it been seven?
7 week. Yeah. Seven week. Yeah.
Oh, congratulations.
Who's counting?
Yeah, he's counting.
Who's counting?
Well, he's in the director's chair right now, so he's staring at me, making the weird noises.
I do hear some noises, yeah.
Smashing. He's just like punching this whale that makes noise. So
nice.
So what's been happening?
We've been talking about story. We've been talking about like the Valset and some of the stuff related to just challenges and opportunities within IP management, I guess would be a good way of saying it. So
grilling and then, Tim, basically.
Well, grilling Tim. Yeah, I know, right? Let's put him on the spot.
It's all good. So I think, grow better, answer better.
And then, so back to your validator ops piece of things, like knowing that you came from different ecosystems, and as you guys went from an L2 and now to a tendermint / kind of EVM based L1, What have you found in terms of like those conversations with the Valset and individuals associated with that, and like just general node ops performance and teams and things like that? Is there any takeaways? Like, has it been different as you entered in some aspects of the Cosmos ecosystem in that way?
So my background is very eccentric. So through like East Layer 1, and then before I had a Saga. The phone, I never touched Solana ecosystem. Yeah. I got in because like Ethereum ecosystem seemed to be like the one. So from the previous like cycle, it's the easiest way to get into blockchain is definitely the Ethereum ecosystem. So obviously layer two, a lot, it's not required that many, node support. And also now, layer one, I think I didn't find that hard. Talking to the validator set, also validator companies, it's really about understanding, first of all, like picking my shit up, like understanding how node operation works. Like, so I run my own node, I dog food my own node, and then experience like, okay, so by how I should run a node, and then further experience on like catching up with all the upgrades, and then maintain a up speed, and then see how that workload goes on. And then it's understanding like, okay, so what we need, like what are the general toolings? Like it's really about data analytics. Like when you talk to 100 people, you kind of have a set of example of 100 different teams talking to you in the way like what they can provide. And then through that, you find a common denominator, like common set of toolings that everyone can provide. So, and then it gave me a baseline understanding what vast majority of the validators work, how they work. Like people will tell you like, okay, so we run this Twitter account, we have this blog writing, and then we write Medium. So that's the common way of looking at our content contribution. And then you have like the Telegram group and Telegram channel, and then also like YouTube channel as a marketing kind of a way. And then for tooling, even easier, like everyone's trying to say like we have RPC, we have indexer, we have scanner, and then we have snapshot, right? We have archive node. So I can see like a lot of it seemed to be more like a common practice for a lot of things that people are doing at the moment. Like they know like by doing this, it's kind of as a contribution. So even though you might not need that many RPC, you might not need that many indexer or scanner, but people do it to show that they are contributing towards the network. Because apart from that, I would look into the code-based contributions, such as PRs and also issues raising. But that will be hard, right? You got to have a dedicated set of people who knows how the core of Gas or how core of Tendermint works in order to start contributing. So it also segment out different teams in terms of their ability, I think.
Choose to reward people for doing PRs, do not tell them beforehand. Whatever you do, do not tell them beforehand. I think it was Juno that said that they would, right? And then they got absolutely blasted by issues from people just being like, hey, you're missing a period. And then it like overwhelmed the entire repo.
And also Scroll. I think Scroll had a PR bump the other when they talked about like developer. I can't remember which project was that. And then people were just, you know, picking all those punctuation missed like errors, like, oh, you missed this full stop, you missed this comma, and then your words were not capital. I'm like, no. I'm not going to mention anything on that beforehand.
So what were some of the contributions that you saw from the Valset that you thought were outside of those? I mean, I would agree that those are kind of like the standard, right? Like, not also just because some groups say that they don't necessarily do that as well. And doing those for a testnet is different than doing those for the rest of your life. We go back to RPC nodes in docs, and like 99% of them are down because they were up for the point of getting in the Valset, and then after that they drop, right? They don't run them anymore. Or they just, you know, it's a thing. And running that and maintaining over time is a big deal. But I'm curious to see, like, what else did you see out of that group? Three other validators in here, right? So what else did you see out of that group? You said, oh, that is something that's totally value add that I'm not seeing everywhere.
Yeah, I think there are, you especially see people with special kind of contributions. For example, like scanners. Scanner actually varies depending on different people, right? How you look at it, and then how you design it, and then how you build it.
What's a scanner?
Explorer.
Oh, that's Explorer. Yeah, sure.
So people were like, so when we talk about like Explorers, there are a lot of effort you should put in, right? For example, like put how many validators, and then the staking, and then so with us you have the staking pool, and then you have different kind of index, and then also because we are using gas as execution layer. So you also do like traditional explorer such as Etherscan type of approach. So one of the team, I won't mention who, but just for, you know. So one of the team actually has this in-house. They are specialized on building those explorer, which was amazing. I think the how they look, and then how we use it, the whole user experience were great. So I do believe that some effort they put in to build a good explorer template, where they are able to transition from one network to the other network. But before we talking how they transfer network, they actually build a really good template, like all the function. And then I think it's more about display now, like for explorer. If your explorer is too kind of too rough or too drafted, like it doesn't give me a, you know, like a kind of like give me a feel like, all right, can I do it? I possibly can also do it. Kind of a feel, but if you actually put effort in, you can feel it, like how they build out the UI, how they build out the user experience. It's actually just like building an application. It's more like building a dApp on top of an ecosystem rather than just saying like we are building a tool for you for the ecosystem to use. So I think that's a very big big difference how you build compare with your mindset of building an application building an application compared with building a tool.
Yeah, I think that's a good example. And plus I think there's explorers that are geared towards different types of end user, like different types of constituents, right? Like MintScan and stuff like that in the ecosystem, I think are really built a little bit more around delegators. I think the work that Nodes Guru does, maybe that was your example, but like Nodes Guru, I think their explorer is a little bit more validator focused than maybe others. Same with Ping, like being able to see like current misses and things like that, which are not across the val set, which are not really easy to do, like in MintScan and things like that. Or even like Celatone, might know from an EVM contract perspective, and like you see showing up in like SayScan and other types of offshoots of that. Obviously, it's much more contract based and doing a little bit more in terms of they don't really care too much about the actual, you know, block or misses. It's really more about contract execution. So I think there's probably a lot of room there, right? Especially and maybe one thing I haven't really seen too much is an explorer that kind of ties in, especially like we have some chains that run both consensus and execution at different block rates, where they get finalized differently, but there's no like, I haven't seen Explorer that pulls those together, right? You know what I mean? Where I can see the consensus layer, I can see the execution layer, and I can see the finalization associated to that. Like those are all kind of cool. I think those are good examples of different types of needs area for sure.
Yeah, I think it is like, so I feel like a lot of times now, like people need to move away. Sometimes I really like Nodes Gurus Explorer. They are very quick. The second day you launch a testnet, they were like, oh, here's the link. Here you go.
Yeah. Just pointing at their own RPC.
But I feel like, so when you want to surprise, and then now it's more like, okay, so Explorer, it's not just an Explorer anymore. It's more about like, okay, so what else I can do? It's more acting like a super app. How I place with Explorer is a super app for the entire like fundamental blockchain. Like you should be able to just directly do like see your network distribution and then see your delegator distribution and then maybe stake, unstake, and also delegate. And then also like tracking on the transaction and also like the block signature. So there's a lot to that people should put towards Explorer. So you don't want people to move around. You just want people to use your Explorer and then experience all the service that they should be experienced, right? So yeah. Otherwise, you move around different website. It actually create a very big large friction. Like you will be your Explorer, you will be only served for certain parts, and then I personally am not a big fan of that. Like I want to use somewhere like I'm Asian, right? Like the one signature in internet era for Asia is super app. It's literally like we look at a history, we know like WeChat, we know Kakao, Line, or Grab. It's really the iconic of how everything just aggregate together. Hmm. So in one place you do everything. I think it's good in a way, but bad also like it's right, more like right, a double-edged right. sword. But for me, like I feel like I need that super app. I need that my there's a super app Explorer alive on our blockchain allows me just to perform all the operation I need. So rather than just going through different Explorer to find the information I need.
Yeah, I totally get that. Being able to like. It's always nice when you go onto a network's website and they have like an ecosystem page and you can kind of bring it all together to like, okay, here's NFTs or whatever, which is oddly uncommon. But yeah, having a central location where you could access everything would be super sweet.
Tim, one last thing just around story before we move away from that is the we were talking about before around like just the wallet use and things like that. One of the areas here, like knowing that you're going to deal with pretty large user base that might not be like traditional crypto users, right? Like you have artists and you have a whole bunch of folks that are not that, I don't want to generalize, but how are you guys thinking about abstraction away from like wallet interfaces and things like that and getting to like more natural, hey, I'm logging into the site and I'm doing these things and is the blockchain component the centerpiece of that tool or is it really, it's behind the curtain. Like this is all this available that we have in terms of functionality and behind the scenes, you got to ensure trust us that this is, there's a huge amount of accountability that goes behind the curtain.
I think it's also a very tough question to answer. Like obviously we know like setting up a wallet in our industry is one of the largest barrier allowing outside audience to join in, like how to teaching them how to use wallet, secure their assets is very difficult. And then further on, you have the off-ramp and on-ramp, like kind of a question like in the future. So how we actually collaborate, so we have several like Web2 projects onboarded to Story with the help of, for example, smart contract, a smart wallet account like Pimlico and also ZeroDAF, and then building a so we also internally trying to build this API. So it's a Web2 API allowing user directly using these smart contract wallets or also like an abstract wallet from Dynamic or Privy to use social login to interact with our protocol rather than saying like, okay, you set up a wallet. Sometimes a lot of those successful dApp that attracted Web2 users into Web3, it's really not about talking to user about wallets or talking to user about tokens or blockchain. It's really about how we make this whole experience more frictionless.
Right.
Like we hide the whole thing in the background. So once they discover, they discover. So like a lot of people, like a lot of Southeast Asian people still don't know, like you can actually top up Grab with your cryptocurrency.
Top up what?
So you know Grab? Grab is a super app in Southeast Asia.
Oh yeah.
You can. They are live on Polygon, and then you are able to top up your Grab wallet by Bitcoin, by Ethereum. So that is a good example here. Like we are talking about, like they don't tell user like, okay, you're able to do it. It's only once you start discovering it, and then you are like, damn, I'm able to do something more than just using my credit card. Right. I think that is just a perfect example, like how we should do stuff. It's not about like you enforce people to have a wallet. It's about providing choice. People can log in by wallet. People can also log in by traditional Google. And then you're trying to create this general interface of digital wallet on top of your smart contract wallet to allow them to use the function.
Yeah, I think that'll be important, right? I think like it has to be a component of that. And I do like that idea. We talked about this before. I think it was with Zion maybe. And, we've talked about it actually a lot of different apps. But the idea that you are enabling the right amount of authentication and kind of control at whatever the user wants, right? Which I think is like your Grab example there, right? Like some people might just top that up through a credit card transaction, and others want to be able to understand and be able to, do that in much more controlling ways, right? And controlling meaning like it's my own funds, it's my own transfer. I'm initiating the way I want to. It's not going through centralized exchanges and all that kind of shit.
Yep.
Yeah. Another good challenge. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of challenge. Yeah.
It's funny.
I mean, that's the irony of being in crypto, right? Is that we, the natives, are like all excited about actually working with our wallets and crypto and trying different things out. But the beauty of crypto will come whenever people don't realize they're using it, which feels ironic. Like nobody cares that crypto's in the background. It just happens to be. Once we can get that working.
Yeah, right. They shouldn't.
I think it's the moment when we stop talking about Web 3 and Web 2 and off-chain and on-chain.
No shit, right?
I really start, I'm forcing myself to stop saying the word Web 3. I feel like it just too. So you are actually forcing yourself to segment out the whole world into two parts,
right?
Like Web 2 and Web 3. But in the end of the day, like everyone run nodes in Huntsnow, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then everyone run nodes on Komboda. So to be honest, there's no difference. Like your server might be next to some Snowflake server. And then you are just using the same spec. It's just the only thing that makes difference is that we have crypto in our wallet, and then people has money in their bank account. So I feel like there's not that much a big difference. So we should just one day when we stop saying like, okay, so how's your wallet, or we can just use something common just to represent the whole concept, then we are there for mass adoption.
Totally agree.
I'm gonna log into Google with my Kepler wallet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, maybe MetaMask. Maybe that one will happen.
Yeah, Kepler's way out.
Tim, anything else you want to talk about around story? Anything we didn't touch on?
No, I think we touched pretty much a lot of that. Especially I like the side people asked about the challenges. I think that there are a lot of challenges we will be facing, and then it's always very exciting to solve those challenges at the same time.
Yeah, that's why you're in the business, right?
Yeah.
If it was easy, everybody'd be doing it. Where should people read more about story?
Definitely our blogs. I think our co-founder Jason is a great writer. He write a lot of great piece piece, and also SY. So don't get too hooked into the beef between us and Barrachain, but I think the whole thesis behind that was great, trying to talk about data ownership and then talking about solving the real problem. So I think we just really want people to understand IP is really about, it's an issue that relates to everyone in the future. is like it's however you only really get involved into it once you get infringed by someone or violated by someone. But to be honest, it's happening to us every day. Like your data on Twitter will never will never be yours, right?
Yeah.
Because the platform controls everything. So similar to your bank account.
I know, totally agree. If we just had somebody on the show who would create a blockchain based Twitter client, which we've
I know. Jeez, maybe on Aptos or something.
Maybe on a new L1. Well, Tim, thanks for joining, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the chance. It's been a great experience talking on this podcast.
I know, which is weird because we never have great experiences for guests on this podcast.
That's right. And ironically, nobody's messaging the comments like normal.
Yeah, we never do. Like sometimes we always ignore by accident. And then maybe it's just because there's tools. Maybe it's just because you and I are here, Schultzy. Maybe that's the issue. Maybe it's the lack of, it's a little bit more focused. Like we were pretty focused in that hour. I got to admit.
Yeah, it is.
I'm impressed.
Even Tim's impressed. All right, dude. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, you bet. See ya.
Yeah.
See ya. So much.
Yep, bye. All right, dude. That was awesome. Look at that.
That was.
We had a guest. We actually did something. We actually had a podcast with actual content.
I really enjoyed talking to him. I'm kind of a sucker for story anyway, just because I mean you know my original startup idea, and that kind of fits pretty well within it. So yeah. I was always really interested in it.
I think it's. I did bring it up. I think it's a tough problem. It doesn't mean it's not solvable. I just think like there's a lot of headway on. And who else didn't somebody try this in the music side in Cosmos, but music only? What was that called? Wasn't that because it was around the same time as it was like early days, right? It was the same time as like Czech. I don't think it's the same thing as this. Don't get me wrong, but
was it BitSong?
It was BitSong. That's exactly what it was. It was BitSong. Yeah.
Oh man, if James listens to this, he's not going to be happy with me. Because so James is a musician and so he's a huge fan of like SoundCloud and so I think he still has a pretty decent amount of BitSong because he was like super hopeful about it. And I was like, I don't know if they're gonna be able to pull it off. And he was like, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, exactly.
The market. Yeah, I think that's the other thing about IP, which we didn't talk about, but like it's so segmented. Like music IP and movie IP, and those are like huge industries, right? And so like where do you start with that? Like what types of medium or even the written word? But like where do you start with that? It can't be everything to everybody, right? Or maybe I don't know. Yeah. It seems like it has to start with something and then it grows from there. But like what industry would be good, right? Like property rights? I don't know. Like where
I think books. My thought was books. I think books would be a good way to start.
Yeah. I don't know. I hope it's successful. Like it's a good idea. And I was honest, like, I don't think IP law should be existing at all, but like it's the way it's written now, it doesn't make any sense. Like, I think it just hinders, especially with like, you know, you got Apple, Google, whatever else, just literally writing patents on every fucking thing. Right. Which I guess is different than the pure IP, but still patent management and everything else kind of goes into that. But yeah,
I mean, anyway. I don't meaningfully know the difference between intellectual property and like a patent, which
that would have been a good question. We should ask them.
I know. I thought about it and I was like, you know what? I'm not going to totally show my hand on how little I know.
I was going to half-ass an answer. I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. That's just shouldn't do that. Anything else you want to talk? Anything else?
I'm feeling optimistic
in the news.
I mean, crypto.
You're feeling optimistic.
Well, yeah. I mean, the market's doing pretty good right now. It seems like there's some decent energy out there.
It's by the fucking hour.
It is
like
by the hour.
Like yesterday it was a shit show. And then today it's like fighting back a little bit.
Well, I'm sure in one more week we'll know better where things are at.
Boy, when is the election anyway? Is it next Tuesday?
I think that's next week. Next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday, right? Yeah. God, I can't wait for this fucking election to be over. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Dude, the weeks before the election are like in the US are the fucking worst. It is the worst. Just media blitz and this and that. And like, just the commentary is so fucking dumb. Like, and like, I don't know. It's just, I just can't wait for it to be over. Honestly, put me on my fucking misery.
I do miss the time when our politics always mattered, obviously, but I miss the time when our politics kind of didn't matter. Right now, the fact that I can go on a bike ride and I see like it's like 2 years before the election and I'm seeing signs out already, I'm like,
oh yeah. Yeah.
I don't need that whenever I'm 30 miles outside the nearest town, driving past some guy's house or riding past some guy's house.
Well, after 2020, I saw signs on yards all the way through 2023.
Yeah.
Even earlier this year, that got replaced with newer signs. Yeah. I know. Well, let's just be, we don't start that conversation, but yeah, I'm just glad it's going to be over soon. So I sent my mail-in ballot. I made 50 copies just to send all 50 in, see what happens. Just hope somebody fucking comments on that. We'll see if they got to the end of the podcast or not.
I've been harassing my friends in Pennsylvania. Like, hey, you're voting, right? Listen, I don't care what you're voting. You don't need to tell me, but you're voting, right? Because
I know PA is becoming important.
Yep. The keystone.
It never was. And nobody gave a shit before. Like, well, maybe 2020, 2016. I'm thinking of if actually PA was even at all a swing state, like in 08. Or an 04. I don't remember it being that way. I could be wrong, but, or even Georgia, like Georgia turning into a swing state, or Arizona. I remember like those things were never like real swing states. Those are like, it was always, and even California has like a pretty, it's getting to be, a little bit more balanced. So anyway,
I love the comments from France prime minister. I think he is another president, prime minister. And he's like, you know, I think we should kind of have our own military because relying on hillbillies from Wisconsin every 4 years, isn't it? Something suspect. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's scathing.
What was that in context to? Like a specific event here or something? What was that about?
Just the election and NATO, because there's talks about NATO being dissolved. And so they're like, So anyway.
Too funny. So next week, we'll have a president defined in the United States, and then we can ignore that for another 4 years.
And then hopefully prices will be better because there's less uncertainty one way or another.
Yeah, uncertainty. I mean, honestly, 100%. Like uncertainty drives really bad things. Like we had that before. Remember with the fucking Bitcoin ETF and like Ethereum ETF. Remember that? We were talking about that a while. Either approve it or don't, but just get out of this fucking circle because it just drives so much swing in terms of everything else.
Yeah. Oh, did you read that the Vanguard CEO was fired because he blocked the Bitcoin ETF and people were angry about it?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sending a warning message to all the other Wall Streeters. Approve that Juno ETF. Let's get going.
That's right.
Oh man. Oh good. Pager duty. What's broken? I don't care.
Anytime I hear pager duty, I just have to check. I'm just like,
speaking of L2s and shitty L2s, not shitty L2s. Speaking of L2s and like some things we never know whether they're working or not. We have a couple mode from Mode Network, MODE, and those L2s have been the most painful and like they're just not transfer, they're just not moving forward. We're not sure exactly what's going on. Like it's been a real pain in the ass. And I was just fighting with that today, trying to figure out what exactly is happening with that. And then also you and I are not much sleep because of, some good old, pager duty in the middle of the night from false alarms that we both got paged at.
I can't believe it happened 4 times. That's too many. And the response by Aptos could have been a little better.
Like it was, sorry about that.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we even got it. I'm sorry. I think they were just like, didn't work.
That was a response of somebody looking at it at noon versus 3 a.m. That's what that was. That was somebody who's like at a desk like, oh, yeah, that's shitty. I wonder why that went off. Off 4 more times. Anyway. Dude, it's 3:45 a.m. Eastern, and my wife is going to fucking murder me. Because she's like, turn it off. I'm like, I literally have no controls over this. Like, I'm searching through the PagerDuty app to say, put my own thing in maintenance. Can't do it. I can't figure out how to turn it off. I can't I can silence the alarm, but then it just clears and then it comes back 10 minutes later. Uh-huh. Oh my God. She's like, go to the couch. Get out of this room.
Well, yeah, so for me, miserable. They came in 2 batches, right? 2 batches of 2.
Yeah.
I had a nightmare between the two where like I woke up thinking that my baby was next to me. And so I like was up for like 5 minutes holding him when he didn't exist, thinking that really? I just woke up with a yeah. And then after like 5 minutes, I was like, wait, it's not my turn. And I went back to sleep. And then immediately got woken back up again by PagerDuty.
Oh my goodness. That's crazy. As long as you didn't like, so you thought he was in your arms?
In bed. Yeah. And I was like, oh man, I feel so irresponsible right now, but I'm so tired. I'm just going to stay in bed.
Oh my goodness.
Which that's a horrible nightmare.
That is, well, I mean, honestly, it is a horrible nightmare, because the other thing that I think comes with lack of sleep and young kids is that eventually you wear out. And in those situations, if you're holding a kid, like there's been bad situations all the time where like somebody gets dropped or somebody gets rolled over on, or you do whatever else because you just can't stay awake. Right. That stuff gets really dangerous for sure.
We are wrecking coffee right now. I was doing pretty good with only a single coffee a day early on.
Single coffee.
I'm very sensitive to caffeine, but right now I'm sleeping so little anyway that I'm like, oh, well, just give me a straight IV. And having an espresso machine, like I've already been happy with the espresso machine, but now I'm especially thankful of like, I'm so happy that I get to have coffee that I like genuinely enjoy right now.
Yeah. I had to move away from espresso because I was pulling shots like crazy, and I would do like two or three double shots through like the morning, and it would be too much. So now I just brew a pot, and I'll drink a liter of coffee though. Don't get me wrong. Like I will drink it's like a small pot. Right. But it's not like for the course of the day, like that's from like eight something till two or something. So anyway, yeah, but like I couldn't pull like those shots. Like there's so much caffeine in those. Like it's like way too much. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, to that team's credit, after I posted something in the Slack saying like this seems like it's not working related to us getting pager duties in the middle of the night, and then somebody reached out from the team like let's talk about this a little bit more, let's understand it. So I came up with a little bit of a workaround, which I don't know if it works, but one thing you might want to do, I was going to tell this to Frey as well, is like right now I'm we have their own Aptos pager duty, right? There's a pager duty that we subscribe to. I have a couple of those with teams where basically we're users on their maintenance, on their monitoring system. And so if something is down with one of our nodes, just for folks who are listening in, that what they do is they basically have the ability to monitor some aspect of our operations and pay and do an alert to us. Right. And so what I did is I changed all my contact information to be an email address at my PagerDuty. And so what that'll do is when they alert it, it'll actually go create an alert on mine. And which means I can then silence it. I can control it. I have management over it. I can escalate it. I can do what I want. So what that doesn't do is it doesn't acknowledge it on theirs, but I don't think they're looking at that anyway, to be honest, whether it's acknowledge or silence, I don't think they really care, because really what they want to do is have people come back to Slack and see if there's anything that needs to be done. And so I started putting on it. I just did that today. I just moved it to mine. So if it runs on mine, then I can say, hey, do this for 24 hours. And so as many times they email that, it won't matter because it's a single incident. And I think I can just mute it, or I could say, hey, I want to know about an hour. If it's a false alarm, I ignore for 12 hours. So we'll see if it happens again. We'll see if my approach is right or wrong.
Yeah. Let me know, because that'd be awesome.
Yeah. So I got rid of all the other communication methods. Actually, it's not true. I think I left it. If it was a couple hours later, if I didn't acknowledge it, I do a text or something, but I just don't want that ability where I keep getting pinged every 30 minutes. And I have no control over it. Or every 10 minutes or whatever the hell it was.
Cause it's not like we can silence our phones. Like we have other alarms.
Not only that, but even if I silence that alarm, I can't, like if I had an issue with Aptos and I knew that there was a false alert, I could at least put it in maintenance for like an hour or something and say, or a couple hours and say, hey, if this thing alarms, I know it's bullshit, so ignore it. And if something else happens in a different area, then it's fine. Right. But this at least allows me to do that, where on their side, I can't do anything. I can't change the schedule. All right. Maybe I can change the schedule. I couldn't mark my own stuff in maintenance. I couldn't do blah, blah, blah. So it's just like, oof. Anyway.
Well, the irony is I don't know what they're really tracking, because I brought my node down once for like 2 hours or something, and they never notified me. So like, what are they tracking? Are they actually tracking your uptime? I don't think so. I think it's like network wide uptime. So it's like if it goes out to one, it goes out to everyone. They only care if a certain amount of the network goes down, which fine. But
yeah, Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think we've ever had, this is the only alert I've ever, the only alerts I've ever gotten have been false alarms.
Same. That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know what they're actually tracking. They're just.
Yeah. And that was my point too, is like, it, like if that's fine, like false alarms are false alarms and I could, we could work around that. But the other thing would be like, there also, there does need to be a way for that team to be able to get people to the channel. Like if there's a vulnerability or something else and hey, we need an emergency upgrade and I need people here. I have no issue with that. Like that totally makes sense. Like there needs to be ways to do that, but not at the expense of now me ignoring Aptos alarms because they're not right.
Yeah.
that was kind of my point. So yeah. I don't know.
All I know is, how do you feel about giving teams a PagerDuty key if you have like an SLA with them?
I do.
You do.
Okay. I do. I give, actually, I don't give a key. I give, I create, I have separate services based on whatever. I have a service strategy and then I will create them an email key for that specific service. Cause you could always generate an email key for any service. And then I'll give it to that team and say, hey, if you need me, fucking put this in your contacts. And so if they use that, then it'll go through a standard high priority escalation type structure. Like it goes apeshit. You know what I mean?
Smart.
So I just give them those for different teams. Oh no, I don't do that. You can do an email. Like you just do a simple email and it has like a GUID at the end of it and it has blah, blah, blah. So, but if somebody emails that, like I do that for like Stargaze, I do it for Say, I do it for a bunch of other ones too.
Smart.
And just like, so that gives the ability to say, it doesn't matter who's on call, but most people just ping me in Telegram anyway. Yeah. Unless it's like if it's an emergency, but nobody's ever used that thing ever. Like it's never happened yet, but they have it, which I guess is, that's good. That's what you want to say, right?
Yeah.
I don't want them. I mean, it means we haven't had an outage or it's been that bad. So at least that's my going in position. All right.
Calling it.
Yeah, we did pretty good. Hour 23. So short, an hour 20. We had a good conversation. We kept it together. There's nothing else. I mean, there's a lot of new shit going on, which is fun.
There is. Yeah.
Some things going to mainnet, which is fun.
Gotta talk about Supra.
We're in mainnet there, I guess. I guess that's happening. I have nodes that I think are being monitored in some sort of way that are producing some sort of thing that might return some sort of reward, I think is fair.
Yep. That's about how I feel about it. Yep.
There's definitely things that are running. There's logs being generated. I see the logs.
Definitely a lot of logs. That's for sure.
Those logs being generated.
And a lot of Google Sheets are being generated. A lot of them.
There's a lot of shell scripts and a lot of Google Sheets being generated.